Amen.
Yep. All right. Chapter 22, verse 15. I'm going to sing the whole class, so I'm just letting you know. We are right in the middle of escalating conflict. Jesus comes in riding on a donkey into Jerusalem, finally. They get a little upset whenever the kids are screaming out things they weren't excited about. They yell at Jesus, tell him to stop. He says no. Psalm 48 says no. He goes on and they question his authority after he curses the fig tree. He refuses to give them an answer because they can't answer his question. But then he goes on to answer the question in three parables that increasingly indict the Jewish elite. Increasingly indict. We talked about it basically, well, we talked about it yesterday. You can look at those. We don't have time to review too much. But now we're going to be moving into three different interactions between the Pharisees and the Herodians to Jesus, between the Sadducees and Jesus, and then the Pharisees take one final shot before Jesus ends the chapter in 22 by giving his own counterattack. So we are in escalating conflict. But the climax of this conflict, though, is going to reach in chapter 23, whenever Jesus says, fine, enough talking for you, I've got a couple things to say, and he will unleash seven woes that definitely leads, understandably, to a death. Because whenever you unleash a seven woes the way he does, well, that's beyond fighting words. So, we are still escalating conflict. A couple of different groups are going to be coming forward to try to trap Jesus. Chapter 22, verse 15. I'll be honest with you, these three interactions may be some of my favorite in the entire book. I love the issues they talk about here. That's just a side note. Just gets me all excited. Anybody writing their paper on these? On any of these? Marriage at the resurrection, paying Caesar's taxes, or the greatest commandment? No one? Well, fine. They're my favorite, but no one cares. All right. Then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him in his words. Okay, the Pharisees have just been publicly shamed, big time. And Jesus has just looked at their political program, he's looked at their political commitments, and he basically said, you know what, you're functioning off a different kingdom. As a matter of fact, the kingdom that you did claim is going to be taken from you and given to someone else. They've been publicly shamed. In a society where honor and shame are what are the things that, the currency of the day, a public shaming was huge. We've talked about this some already, right? The concept of honor and shame in their culture. In our culture, what we value is time and money. In their culture, what they value is honor and shame. Have we talked about this? Okay. In an honor-shame society, if you have a public shaming, you have to regain the honor in some way. Otherwise, you will be perpetually shamed. Because, especially, people become very zealous about regaining honor because honor is a limited commodity. It is just like money. There is only so much amount of money you can get. Just ask Bill Gates. Whenever he was worth $90 billion, the American government said, that's too much, and they cut him in half. Now he's worth $40 billion. So he's hurting now. Kind of. Not really. Sorry. I went on a Bill Gates train in my mind. What was I talking about? Only so much money that you can get. In their society, there's only so much honor you can get. And if someone takes away your honor, the only way you can get it back is if you re-challenge that person publicly. Publicly. And you have to win the battle. You have to win the shame. And what happens is, in the public view, the society is the one that gives and takes away honor. So it needs to be public because they are the ones that vote whether or not you are worthy or not. If you claim to be more honorable than what you are and the society rebukes you down to how they view you, that is shaming. So you don't want to overclaim your honor in their society because if you do, that could be shameful. At the same time, when it's very clear that you've been shamed, you have to get the honor back somehow. And right now, the one that's holding the most honor is Jesus. They've just had multiple interactions, actually over the past 21 chapters, multiple interactions, and every time they've been shamed. Now, Jesus comes and the most blatantly, in parables, tells them, kingdom's going to be taken away from you. Matter of fact, it's going to be given to the tax collectors and the prostitutes. The outcasts are going to take your position. He's elevated their honor, he's taken their honor, and they want it back. And that's why you see them coming, and they're trying to trap Jesus. And eventually, they realize that even the word trap's not working, so they're gonna have to kill him if they want their honor back. And they're okay with that. Because literally in the ancient world, we have kings that will go bankrupt. They will bankrupt the entire empire as long as their bankruptingness gains them honor. Because what's most important to them is not money. What's most important to them is honor. And they will spend all the money they have and then some in order to gain more honor. Okay? It's beyond keeping up with the Joneses. It's beyond that. As a matter of fact, one of the ways you can gain a lot of honor is if you throw a lavish party. Lavish party. A lot of times the money that they spend is spent on other people, because if you spend on other people, that person will be an advocate for you to get you more honor. So you see how this game works? There's a constant honor game that's going on in the ancient world. It's still going on today. If you go to the Middle East, I've told you that story before where I was up there trying to buy a phone card from this guy at a booth. Next thing I know, he's gone. And even though I could have taken the phone card and my money, what was most important to him is there was an honor situation that was going on over here, and he needed to go deliberate it. Because the ones that divvy out the honor also gain honor. It's an honor game. It's consistent. I'll be honest, this is one of the reasons why we are having so many foreign policy issues with our American government, with other governments. Because we are not viewing our interactions with them through honor and shame. We don't get it. For example, if we take over two Muslim countries, we have just shamed not just their country but their religion, Allah. And guess what? How are they going to get it back? They will do anything it takes to gain their honor back, even drive planes into buildings. Because for them, life's not as important as honor. And if they can kill someone, if they can go blow themselves up in a whole avenue of people, and that will gain their family honor, that's worth it. See, so one of the main problems with right now with foreign policy is we're moving on different tracks. We don't function on honor. In our society, nothing is honorable, nothing is shameful. Everything's just free for all. In their society, honor and shame is still the driving force, which is, I think I've said this before too, but hey, it's revamp day. This is the reason why, and listen to this very carefully. I'm getting a little more political than I want to today, but yeah, whatever. You're big boys and girls, you can handle it. This is the reason why Ahmadinejad denies the existence of the Holocaust. It has nothing to do with him being a bad historian. It has to do with the fact that the world refuses to recognize the Holocaust of the Palestinians in 1948, where 800,000 of them were displaced or killed. And he says, if you won't acknowledge their Holocaust, I refuse to acknowledge yours. Why? Because that's my brother and you've taken honor away from them. See, honor and shame functions on a totally different level, where everything is at risk, everything's up in the air if honor can be gained. And that's the situation we're dealing with here with the Pharisees and Sadducees. They have had honor ripped away from them, and they're going to do whatever it takes to get it back. Make sense? You start to understand now why Jesus was killed more? It's not just because he was a guy that made them mad. He's ripping away their honor, and they had to gain it back somehow. And instead of bowing down to him, they were fighting for their positions of power because they want to sit at the right and the left hand. See how the disciples fall into that lens too? Okay, enough. Then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. Okay, now you can see the political posturing happening right now. What they did, notice, who do the Pharisees, who do the elite, the Jewish elite send? Their disciples. Because they've already been shamed enough. And here's kind of the political posturing behind this. If we send our disciples and he beats them, well, big deal. Those guys were idiots, obviously. But if those disciples shame him, if they win, then how much more honor will come to their masters? See what they're doing? If we send our disciples and they lose, it's a little bit of a shame on us, but not too big of a deal because they're our disciples. But if they win, huge honor gain for us. Because if our disciples can trump this guy, then that means obviously everybody would look at us and say, you guys would be able to destroy him then. Right? How much more? So they send the disciples. Also, notice who the disciples are going with. The Herodians. How do the people view the Herodians? Who are the Herodians? Who is their primary allegiance to? Yeah, the family of Herod the Great. Herod Antipas, Herod, Philip I, Herod the Great. So that's their primary. Now, how does society view Herod the Great's family and the Herodians? Do we know? What? Not well. Yeah. Not well, because who is Herod the Great? Who are their family? Who is their family? Who is the... Anyway, correct me grammatically later. They're oppressors in that Rome has made them the kings of Jerusalem, made them the kings of Israel, but they're not even Jewish. They're Idumeans. They're not even full-blooded Jew, and yet they're the kings of the Jews? These are people that are in the back pocket of Rome. The Herodians are the ones that if what Rome says, they're going to support. Why? Because Rome gave them all their power, and they've aligned with the people with the most honor. And the Jews do not respect that at all. So they're going with the Herodians. Now notice the situation they're setting up. In the question that they're about to ask, should you pay taxes to Caesar? If Jesus says, yes, pay taxes to Caesar, the Herodians would be going, that's what I'm talking about. And the people would be going, hold on, you're aligned with the Herodians? If he says no, the Herodians would be going, hold on, you mean you're going to defy Rome? Do you really want me to go tell my boss that you're going to defy him? Because you know what he does, don't you? As a matter of fact, in AD 6, there was someone known as Judas the Galilean. Judas the Galilean, because this is one of the first times, I'm skipping ahead in my notes, we'll skip this later. Where was that at? There it is. In AD 6, Judas the Galilean, the Roman taxation was being asserted onto the people of Judea. And Josephus says this is Judas Galilean's response. He says, yet there was one Judas who became zealous to draw them to a revolt, who both said that this taxation was no better than an introduction to slavery, and exhorted the nation to assert their liberty. And the result of Judas Galilean's disapproval of this particular tax was wars, fights, and eventually Rome's hand crushed them. So what you have is this question that no matter which side Jesus goes on, he is going to lose honor. Because if he sides with the Herodians, the people that were just saying Hosanna in the highest are going to be going, if you're just another one of them, I don't want anything to do with you. If he sides against the Herodians, or if he says, oh no, don't pay the taxes to Caesar, all of a sudden Rome's going, do we have another Judas Galilean situation here that we need to deal with? Should we crush you like we crushed him? Is that what you need us to do? So they're setting up a pretty sophisticated trap. It makes a lot of sense why they're driving this way. Do you have a question?
Weren't the Pharisees and Sadducees like a reaction to the Herodians?
They were a reaction to the Hasmoneans.
Oh, it's a Hasmonean.
Yeah, the Hasmonean dynasty in the intertestamental period was Judas Maccabeus' family ends up establishing under John Hyrcanus the Hasmoneans. And because John Hyrcanus took the power as both the king and the priest... but he was not full-blooded Jewish as well, and he wasn't from the right... He wasn't from the right lineage of either one, the Davidic lineage or the Zadokite lineage. As a result of that, they said, hold on, you're just somebody that's coming over us that's just as impure as who was over us. And so that's whenever the Pharisees were created, then the Sadducees were created. Herodians came a little bit later because it's whenever Rome took the power away from the Hasmonean dynasty as a whole. Then they inserted Herod, I think it was in 46 BC. And when they inserted Herod, because of his own political posturing, that's when the Herodians, the supporters of Herod, came about. So Hasmonean dynasty is how the Sadducees and the Essenes and the Pharisees were created, about 2nd century BC. Let's keep moving. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. Teacher, where else have we heard that word? Is that a good word in Matthew?
No.
Who speaks that word in Matthew? Broader group. Outsiders. Outsiders. It does not necessarily mean that they're trying to kill Jesus, because remember the rich young ruler says this same word. And it wasn't mean that he was trying to trap him, but you could clearly see just by the word he's an outsider. If you say the word teacher to Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew, you are not a part of his community. Yet. It doesn't mean you can't be. It just means you're functioning off a different lens. Teacher. Matter of fact, every one of these interactions will start off with that word. Teacher. Sadducees come to him, teacher. The Pharisee comes to him in the first greatest commandment, teacher. outsiders talking. Teacher, they said, we know that you are a man of integrity. Oh, well. And that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Notice what they're doing. They're acknowledging the honor that he's gained. Not because they agree with it, but because they're setting him up. If they build him up really big in their interaction at the beginning, and then he falls, how much further would he fall? See what they're doing? And that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by men, because you pay no attention to who they are. Ironic. Ironic that the Pharisees are saying that. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? So the trap's laid. At that point, this is a politically explosive question. Because there is literally, no matter what Jesus says, he's going to be in odds with some sort of political kingdom, whether it be Rome or the Jewish one. This has no good answer. Well, so we think. We get to that in a minute. Ooh. But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, "You hypocrites." That word is going to come up all the time in chapter 23. Matter of fact, we're going to be talking about how that word, you know what that word means, most of you, in the Greek, but it's basically somebody that's on a stage in the Greek theater. He'd be wearing a mask. He would then take his mask and change depending on which character he was. And that person was called a hypocrite. Not because they were fake, but because they were acting in a play. Not who they really were. And that's kind of where this word derives from. You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax. Brilliant. Here's why. Let's look at the coin that they would have shown him. On the front, right here, that's Tiberius. That's Tiberius. Right here is Livia. Livia was Augustus's third wife. And it was the mother of Tiberius. It was Tiberius's mom. But she, well, we'll get to her in a minute. First of all, let's read what's around the side of Tiberius. Around it, I'll just translate it. It's the Latin, and it's kind of hard to see here because the T and the I are kind of off. And it says Caesar, Divi, and then you have on the other side A-U-G or A-V-G because it's Latin. And then it says Phi and then Augustus. And what all that says is this. Well, it says Tiberius, the T-I is Tiberius, Caesar, so he's emperor, but then Divi is divine. So Tiberius, the divine Caesar, the God Caesar, okay? Then the other side, A-U-G, would be Augustus. In other words, it's another word for the emperor, the one that's a part of the pure lineage. And then he is literally Phi Augustus, the son of Augustus, because his mom is Livia. So right on the front, you have the coin claiming that this is God. Tiberius, the one that is reigning at the time of Jesus, he is God. On the back's his mom. She's holding a palm or an olive branch. And behind her, she's holding a spear that's inverted. And what it says here is Pontiff Maximus, which means high priest. So, we have this coin that says he is the king and he is the priest, he is God. This is the coin that Jesus asked to see. And the Jews would have multiple problems with this, as you can imagine. Number one, the things being said about him would be considered what in the Jewish lens? Blasphemous! This guy is claiming to be God and the high priest and the king over everything. Number two, Exodus chapter 20 says, this is a graven image. They took very seriously, the second commandment, which says, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. And the reason why they took it so seriously is because idolatry is one of the key reasons the prophets champion as to why they're in exile to begin with. So by the time Jesus comes around, they're really meticulous about what is considered idolatry and what isn't. As a matter of fact, there was even a law that there were not graven images to be allowed even in the city of Jerusalem itself. It wasn't even allowed to be brought in. And this became a major sticking point in Josephus, Jewish Wars 2.9.2-4. He describes this event with Pontius Pilate, the guy that's going to kill Jesus here in a couple of chapters. Pontius Pilate, at nighttime, uses soldiers to smuggle in graven images into the city of Jerusalem. They have all these insignias of the emperor all around the city. And the Jews, the next day, they wake up and they see him and they freak out. And they go to him and they're like, you've got to take these down. This is desecrating our city. This is desecrating our temple. This is a big deal. And for 5 days they argued. 5 days they argued with Pontius Pilate. And finally on the fifth day, Pontius Pilate set him up. He gathered them all together, all the Jewish elite. He gathered them into a central location. And then what he did is he had all of his soldiers disguise themselves and completely surround them. And at Pontius Pilate's signal, all the soldiers revealed themselves, drew their swords, and held them to the Jewish elite. And Pontius Pilate says, either you accept all of these graven images, or you will die. And what the Jews did in that moment is very fascinating. They all got down on their knees, they stretched out their necks, and they said, kill us. And there were so many of them, Pontius Pilate was like, oh my word, if I kill them, this whole city is going to explode. And Pontius Pilate backed down. He took down the images because of the violent Jews' nonviolent act. Very interesting. So he takes down the images. So the graven image thing's a big deal. Now, let's continue to develop how this asking for a coin is brilliant on Jesus' part. Because where are they right now? They're in Jerusalem. And Luke 20 verse 1 says, in the temple courts. Why is that significant? Because the Jewish elite have a graven image, not only inside of the city, but in the temple itself. Jesus says, isn't it interesting that you guys are upset with me when it comes to colluding with Caesar? And yet you guys are the ones that are breaking the law very clearly. You've brought a graven image that says this guy is king and priest, that says he is the God over all, into God's temple. You did that. So initially what he does whenever they're able to produce one is he says, doesn't this indict you too? But he says, let's continue to talk. They brought him a denarius, which is what that is, and he asked them, whose portrait is this and whose inscription? Notice he points to both. He says, now, whose graven image is this? Oh, Tiberius. Now, what does the inscription say? Oh, blasphemy. So you have a coin like this. Okay, just making sure we're all on the same page. And what's their answer? Well, I mean, it's Caesar's, they replied. Then Jesus said to them, then give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God's what is God's. You see, we need to read this through the lens of Matthew 17, 24 through 27, the temple tax. Whenever Peter's really down because they ask the question, hey, does your teacher have to pay the tax? And in that moment, he had to admit that Jesus isn't even officially recognized as a rabbi. And Jesus says, but you don't understand. When we pay the temple tax to them, it's actually an act of subversion. It's not pledging allegiance to them that are taking the tax from us. It's actually pledging allegiance to God Himself, because we trust that even when we pay them taxes, He still is in control. Now listen, this is what Jesus does. He says, now listen to me. Why would you want this coin anyway? Why would you want this anyway? It's a graven image and it's blasphemous. Are you telling me that I should want this coin? Is that what your question is about? Are you asking, should I want this coin? Do I really want this to be carrying around all the time? Matter of fact, if Caesar asks for it back, he's doing me a favor. Then I don't even have to have this stinking thing in my possession at all. Because it's blasphemous and a graven image. So you know what? Let Caesar have it. Give back to Caesar what's his. Because it clearly is his. Is anybody going to deny that? Are you going to say, no, it's mine. It is yours? So you like to hold on to blasphemous things that break the commandments of God. You like that, Jews, do you? And they're going, well, no. No, it's just got to pay the tax. And Jesus says, no. Don't look at it through the lens of taxes in the sense of this world. Look at it through the lens of the kingdom. I want Caesar to have what's his. And even whenever he gets what's his, he's still not in control. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, pay Caesar his tax so that you don't be committing blasphemy. But know that even whenever you're paying him a tax, it doesn't mean he's in control. It doesn't mean you're pledging allegiance to him. What it means is that you trust God so much that even whenever it looks like Caesar's getting everything, God is still in control. See what he's doing? And then he asked the question, give to God's what's God. It's not a question, it's a statement, but there is a question. What is God's? Well, it's whatever his image is on. And just two chapters ago, Jesus referenced the passage in Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, didn't he? In what context did Jesus say, Genesis 1, verse 27? Divorce. So both male and female were created in his image. He's already talked to them about the image of God. And he says, so if the image of God, then what should we give to God? Well, what belongs to him? And then he's like, doesn't that make everyone happy? You see what he's doing? He's saying, you're looking at this whole situation through the wrong lens. You think, like Judas Galilee, that if I stop paying the tax, then I'm actually devoting myself to God. But what you're saying is you just want to keep the coins that are blasphemous. Who wants these? Give them to Caesar. Let him have it. And give to God what is God's. It's you. All of you. Because that's what he wants. He doesn't want your stinking money. He wants you. Switches it on them. Now all of a sudden they're like, well, that's frustrating. When they heard this, they were amazed. Ah, job well done, my friend, job well done. So they left him and went away. That same day, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, I noticed the Sadducees come in. They're like, those stupid Pharisees screwed up. We will come in and now gain even more honor. Because when the Pharisees were shamed again, Jesus gained more honor. And if we, the Sadducees, can take Jesus down, we will get the honor that even the Pharisees lost. Big political opportunity. The same day, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, huge detail to understanding this whole passage. Huge detail. The reason why it's huge is because their whole question is going to be about the resurrection, isn't it? They built up this scenario. We'll talk about that in a minute. But basically, they're asking the question, so at the resurrection, as if there is one. They don't even believe in a resurrection. And the reason why is because they don't believe it can be found in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. They don't believe it can be found there. And as a result, they say since it can't be found there, it's not true. You have to add to Jewish theology. So they reject things like Daniel 12 referring to a resurrection. They reject the oral traditions that point to a resurrection. This is a major point of contention between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. So what I basically am trying to say is this. The very question they ask Jesus, they don't even believe in. Don't even believe that it's a possible answer. They're making fun of the Pharisees for even believing in something as foolish as the resurrection. So they're, in a sense, trying to gain honor on two fronts. Because if they can trap Jesus in this question, they can also prove that Jesus is foolish as well as the Pharisees. They don't even believe in the resurrection, but they're going to ask a question about it. Which I think may give us a clue of how Jesus even responds to this question. But we'll get to that in a moment. They came to ask him a question. Okay, teacher, they said, Moses told us that if a man dies without having children, his brother must marry the widow and have children for him. This is known as levirate marriage. Deuteronomy chapter 25, 5 through 6. I'm going to read it because it's significant. Listen to what is being protected in this context. Moses writes, if brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside of the family. Why? Why is that significant? What would be lost if she married outside of the family? Honor. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother. Why? So that he doesn't lose honor. So that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. It is shaming the fact that the guy was married, could not have a son, and now his name will die because he died. And what he is doing, what Moses is doing, is putting something in place that protects the honor of the entire family by saying it is the brother's responsibility to protect the honor. Therefore, he needs to take his brother's wife if he dies and have her bear him a son. And when that son is born, he doesn't take the name of his father. He takes the name of his true father, and that is his brother. Is it making sense? I'm not asking if you agree with it. I'm asking, does it make sense why they're doing this? Yes? Holler if you hear me. Be awake. Help me. All right. Cool. Holler. Thanks. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 through 6. Levirate marriage. Okay. So now, that's the setting. That's what they say. Moses told us to do this. Okay. And Jesus is like, yeah, I've read Deuteronomy. Now, here comes their situation. Now there were seven brothers among us. The first one married and died, and since he had no children, he left his wife to his brother. The same thing happened to the second and third, right down to the seventh. Finally, the woman died. Now then, at the resurrection, whose wife will she be of the seven, since all of them were married to her? This actually comes from the Apocrypha, this story, this situation. It's from the book of Tobit. Yeah. Absolutely. What it is in that situation is there's a woman named Sarah. And she has been married seven times. But each night on the night of their wedding night, where they were going to consummate the marriage, the demon Asmodeus comes, abducts the husband, and kills him. Therefore, she has been legally married seven times, but never consummated the marriage. So she's barren. And Tobias, the son of Tobit, Tobias is... on his way to a different... I'm not going to get into that part. He's on the way somewhere. And the angel Raphael, who is disguised as his companion, comes and tells him about his cousin, Sarah. And he says, hey man, this is the situation. The Levirate marriage situation, your honor of your family, rests now on you. And Tobias was like, well, my word, she's getting killed. What am I going to do? And around that time, this huge fish comes out of the water and tries to attack Tobias. And Tobias is like, oh no. And Raphael's like, chill out, man. Actually, get that fish, kill it, and we're going to use that to get rid of the demon. And that's what happens. He takes the entrails. He uses that in order to cause some sort of incense. The demon runs away. He gets Sarah, and they live happily ever after. He fulfills the family honor by upholding the levirate marriage that's described in Deuteronomy 25. That's the situation. But they change the ending. They say she has legally been married seven times. All of them die, and now... she dies. So here's the question, Jesus. At the resurrection, who will she be married to? A lot of times people will use this verse, this context, Jesus' answer, to say, in heaven, we will not be married to even the people you're married now. That you will not have sex in marriage or in heaven. That whole earthly, fleshly thing is destroyed. That's a lot of times what they say. Because, you know, we'll be like the angels. And here's my response. We're reading that through the lens of the way that we define marriage, not the way they define marriage. Because for them, marriage was not about love and about sex. It was about honor. It was about provision. It was about the perpetuity, if I'm allowed to use that word, to perpetuate the honor of the people that you were responsible for. That's why it was so important for them to marry their husband's wife, or their brother's wife, in order for the honor to be taken care of. But you have to understand, if a woman's been married seven times legally, never bore a son, and each of them have died, she is an honor liability, isn't she? Because there's a couple things going on there. As a matter of fact, in the ancient world, until a woman bore a son, until she gave birth to a son, she was considered an alien in the family. An outsider. She was not even considered a part of the actual family until she gave them a son. Which, if you are outside of the family, you're an honor liability. You are a consistent challenge to the honor of the family. She is an outsider until she bears a son. That's one strike against this woman. Number two strike is every person she marries dies. She's clearly cursed. And somebody that's in your family that just keeps killing one husband after another, that's not good for your honor. And so what basically the Sadducees are asking is this. Who has to bear the burden of this honor liability once they get to the resurrection? This woman is a wreck when it comes to honor. She should be kept as far outside of the family as possible. But who has to be responsible for this liability once the resurrection happens? Because seven of them will be trying to push her on the other one. You see the issue? Little different than how we interpret it. It's not about who gets her. It's about who is stuck with her. Who is burdened with this piece of property. Notice the language I'm using there is purposeful. They're not looking at the woman as somebody that they love deeply and just want to be with. But at the resurrection, who does she belong to? They look at women as a piece of property they don't really want, but they have to tolerate because they bear sons. And they say, who's burdened with this in the resurrection? You see how the question's a little different? Which is why I think Jesus' response is different than how we normally translate it. Not to mention the fact, I will say this really quick. Even in the Garden of Eden, absolute bliss, there was, marriage and sex. It's not, don't think through the eyes of Plato that everything that's fleshy is evil. It actually was made and it was called good, I think. And I don't think that the curse destroyed that. I don't think the curse is that powerful. Yeah? The resurrection, in the Jewish mind, well, in the Pharisees' mind, the one thing need to happen at the eschaton, well, I can't put a cross there because they wouldn't agree with that. Whenever the Messiah comes, several things happen. The golden age has occurred. Also, though, since the golden age began, the Pharisees would say that's also whenever the Old Testament saints would be resurrected. Daniel chapter 12 alludes to this. It doesn't come out specifically. Even in the Psalms, there's some discussion of coming back from the grave, my bones that don't decay, things of that nature. At the eschaton, the resurrection would occur, a new creation would occur, Israel would be put on to their status of exaltation. And what Jesus does by being resurrected is he takes what's supposed to happen in the future and says it also is a part of history. So that's what they're envisioning when it comes to the resurrection. The rising of the dead at the end. But the Sadducees didn't believe that there was a life after life. That's not what they believed. They didn't believe in a resurrection. Okay, all right, Jesus answered. Jesus replied, "You are in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God." Love it. Jesus responds to them with two answers. First, at the resurrection, notice he affirms it, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. Again, you cannot define marriage through our lens. What he's saying is this. They're like the angels. Whose responsibility is it? Who bears their burden? God bears the burden of everyone. All honor that is accumulated or protected in heaven or at the resurrection is God's responsibility. The woman that whose responsibility of her or who is responsible for her, God is. Because that's how the community is defined. You don't understand the way the kingdom works. And you don't understand the way the afterlife works. You're missing this on all levels. He's not saying, oh no, no one's going to be able to love anyone in heaven. Everybody is going to be absolutely equal. That's not what he's saying. I reject the idea that there will be no marriage in heaven in the sense that what we've been married down here will be eradicated when we get there. That's not what he's saying. Because marriage is not defined through our lens of love and sex. Marriage defined there is the burden of property. And he says, in heaven, no one's going to be a burden of anyone because God's going to be bearing all the burden. It's just like the angels. Who is the one that's responsible for their honor and for their burden? God. God is. But if we define marriage through our lenses, it's very confusing. If we define it through their lenses, it starts to make more sense. Who is responsible for this woman? And Jesus says, at the resurrection, God's responsible for everyone, for absolutely everyone. They will be like the angels in heaven. Blah, blah, blah. Verse 31. But about the resurrection of the dead. So notice his first one is, you guys don't even understand how the family, the kingdom of God works. Second response. Have you not read what God said to you in the Pentateuch? By the way, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. He says in the Pentateuch, Exodus chapter 3 verse 6 says, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And his question is this, were those patriarchs dead whenever he was saying that? Yeah. So if he is saying that he is the God in the present of these people, but they're dead, how does that make any sense? What does he claim it? I'm the God of dead people. Awesome. Say no. He says, I am the God of the living Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he goes to the Pentateuch and shows that what they are doing is overlooking key aspects of something that they should be adhering to, the resurrection. So they come to him, ask a question they don't even believe in. Jesus challenges the question not only on the grounds of their conclusion, but also on the grounds of their presupposition they don't believe in the resurrection. He shatters both. He says, you don't understand how the kingdom's functioning, and you've even misinterpreted the Pentateuch, the only five books you even look at. 4 minutes, we can make it. When the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. Man, this dude's crazy. Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. Notice, whoa! If he shot them down, we can gain their honor and ours back. This is a good opportunity, politically. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with his question, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your mind." Where does that come from in the Old Testament? Yes, the great Shema, which is in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6. He almost quotes this verbatim. In every Jew, the great Shema, they would recite every day. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And so you hear whenever Jesus says, this is the greatest commandment, you almost hear in the background Jews going, amen? Amen. The great Shema. Job well done. Good answer. Finally, one that we can agree on. And then he says this. And the second is like it. That phrase right there bothers me. Because you sit there and you go, hold on. What in the world can be like the first? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. There is nothing like that, Jesus. Right? Absolutely nothing like that. And he says, no, actually the second greatest commandment is pretty much just like the first. And what is it? Leviticus 19. And the second is like the first. Love your neighbor as yourself. Matter of fact, 1 John, I make my Christian life class memorize three chapters out of 1 John. Because I believe that 1 John, a lot is written on this text. And I think it climaxes in 1 John chapter 4, 20 through 21. I love this. He is the best apostle. Well, we can talk about that later. But I love this. I love these verses. John says, if anyone says, I love God. So if anyone says, I keep the first greatest commandment, yet hates his brother, denies the second greatest commandment, John says, he is a liar. Flat out, a liar. Why? For if anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And he has given us this command. This is the command that John says Jesus gave us. Whoever loves God must also love his brother. John takes the first greatest commandment and the second greatest commandment and makes them into like one mega commandment. He says, how do you do the first one? By doing the second. You want to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength? Love your neighbor like you love your stinking self. And you love yourself an awful lot, don't you? You see what he's doing? Whenever I was in school here, there was our theme for our dorm. One semester was I Choose Third. And I hated that theme. It was based off of this passage. And the thought process was God's first, neighbor second, I'm third. And I had my dorm parent walk out on me because I gave a dorm devo. And I just said, our theme is screwing up this entire text. Because the whole point of the text is for you to get lost. Not for me to look at this text and identify where I'm at. The text says, God's first, people are second. You're gone. You lose yourself in Jesus by loving people. So you don't look at this passage and say, no, where am I? Oh, I'm third. No, you're non-existent. You're gone. You lose yourself in the kingdom. You don't choose third. Your Lord said you don't get to choose who you are or what you are. I choose it. God first, people second, you're gone. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. The whole Old Testament was trying to get the Jews to act like this, and they were missing it. Over and over, they were missing it. Real quick. While the Pharisees were gathered together, so Jesus says, now wait a minute, I'm not going to let you guys get away with asking me a question. I'm going to ask you one. What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he? Well, that's easy. He's the son of David, they replied. He said to them, how is it then that David, speaking by the Spirit, calls him Lord? For he says in Psalm 110, verse 1, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. If David calls him Lord, how can he be his son? You see what they're saying? The Messiah, although he's pretty stinking cool, he is inferior to David because he's a son. And the sons are always inferior to their father. And Jesus says, well, if that is true, then how come in the Davidic psalm, the one that is written by David, Psalm 110, that David says, the Lord, Yahweh, says to my Lord, the Messiah. And Jesus says, if he's inferior as a son, then how come David calls him Lord, as if he were superior? Their response? Well, no one said a word. They couldn't say a word in reply. And from that day on, no one dared to ask him any more questions. But that does not mean the conversation ends. You hear that? No one's going to ask him any more questions, but Jesus does not let the conversation stop. Because chapter 23, he says, all right, you may be done talking, but I'm not. And what we're going to talk about next Tuesday is Jesus unleashing the seven woes on the Pharisees whenever he says, you may be done challenging my honor, but I'm going to reveal you for who you really are. Have a good weekend. Love you guys. See you on Tuesday.